This is Philosophy versus Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well.
This is Mark Lintonmeyer summoning the spirit of philosophy forth to bring to you the people.
And this is Bill Arnett conjuring the energy that is improv, I guess also to bring to people. Yeah.
This is Invasive Thoughts. I'm Hafiz.
I'm Nicholas.
Thanks for inviting us.
My summoning brought forth two flesh and blood human beings. What did yours bring, Bill?
It brought forth a wonderful spirit of collaboration.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
I'm a little skeptical. Nicholas and Kafiz, you both teach at St. John's College. Is that right? In Annapolis, Maryland?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we started right. Same year, 2020, in the middle of the COVID pandemic.
So you didn't actually get to see people.
We saw them like this. I mean, Zoom philosophy is familiar to us for that reason.
Right. So this is starting to feel very nostalgic, right? Exactly. Or this is starting to bring us memories of the wonderful and glorious 2020 and 2021. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, were they looking attentive? Do you have stories to share from those days? Were they putting the still picture of themselves? Was the discussion hampered in any way, did you feel, by being remote?
So we were fully on Zoom in the fall of 2020, right? And then spring 2021, the college switched to what we called hybrid, where, you know, those students who wanted to be in person could be in the classroom. And then we also had, like, I think it was called the OWL, this really weird device that would sort of, like, you know, rotate around with its camera. I'm sure a lot of people know what that is. I have memories of it from back then. So what were the surprises? I mean, I remember the first time I entered the classroom, like in person, saw my students for the first time in person. I mean, the first shock is, wow, they have legs, right? That was kind of a universal joke, right?
Sure.
At the time. And then I remember I was just so surprised at how much younger they looked in person as opposed to Zoom.
Okay.
Well, I'll say I remember one student who was very, very quiet and very serious and very young looking. And I just thought, wow, he's such a young but serious, mature presence. And then I met him in person for the first time. And he was about 6'4" and I'm about 6 feet. So he just towered over me. And I just thought, wow, you know.
Right, right.
That's a surprise.
Oh, yeah. No, I even know who that student is. But that's one of the things about Zoom, right? The height doesn't really translate. Like, I guess, like, we have no idea how tall we all are.
Right.
But it doesn't matter.
We're merely creatures of the mind. We philosophers, at least. I don't know about you improvisers. You have to be there bodily.
You know, hey, it helps. It helps. Let's be honest. It helps.
Have you ever done any Zoom improv?
There was some that occurred. It was mostly improvisers and diehards performing for each other and keeping the rust off than it was selling tickets and and general public coming in. But it happened. Oh, it's tricky. It's difficult. There are some cool things about the medium that you can't do live. Like, it's easy to hide yourself in a Zoom thing and suddenly not be on stage in the blink of an eye. And it's much more difficult to do that live. But in general, it's more difficult. Read faces, read postures, read emotions, all that stuff. It gets hampered with Zoom.
Did you ever mute yourself when you couldn't think of a line and then say, oh, I'm sorry, and then unmute yourself?
Then... Oh, that's a good move. Yeah, I might try that. Yeah,
I definitely like froze myself to like yawn. Or like,
I have a cough button. So if I really want to just sigh with fatigue at what someone else is saying, then I can just do that.
Yes. Although we can see you.
You can see me. Let me see if you can tell. That was great for listeners.
Yeah. there was a shift in your weight, your body weight came forward a little bit as the sigh emerged, but it was silent.
So I don't know that I'd really explain this to you, Bill. So Partially Examined Life has deep connections to St. John's College.
Okay.
In that one of our hosts was a tutor, as they call the professors there, and one of them was an undergrad student there. And we've had several of them on as guests. And it's a kind of a unique Great Books discussion seminar in that they just throw the students in. This is why the professors are tutors, because they don't like give them a lecture.
Yeah.
They just, as freshmen, say, okay, you read the book. Now talk. And they just stare at each other and they have to figure out how to do it from scratch.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. They stare at each other for 4 years and then they graduate.
There is definitely something. I have been in my life, COVID took a big bite out of the improv game and the performance game in general and corporate training game in general. So I've been doing a lot of substitute teaching. In the last year and a half, every grade K through 12, I have subbed at some point. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is, and I don't know if this is a philosophy thing, but you go from a place in elementary school where you're trying to get the right answer. The teacher has the right answer, and you're trying to get the right answer. And then in high school, it slowly becomes, well, the teacher doesn't always have the answer, but you are trying to you know, to, and then certainly in college, or it's, well, certainly in life, mm-hmm. it's like your boss doesn't have the answer. That's why they hired you. How much cash is in the drawer? I don't know. You know, there's no, and I think, I don't know if it's something about maturity or what that means, but getting students, and I'm sure you probably smack right into this, to truly believe and understand what it means for the professor to not have the answer, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, at St. John's, I suppose we're only supposed to have one question, right?
Well, that's right. It's not just talk. There is a prompt.
Right, when you come into the seminar. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, minimally, you ask the opening question, and you could just sit back, right? I mean, we usually don't. But for me, you know, part of being a tutor is exactly as you said, is that, like, I'm not expected to give answers. I'm not expected to profess, to lecture, or to teach in any kind of, like, you know, straightforward sense of the term, which is kind of great. I mean, when I'm asked, what does it feel like to be in the St. John's classroom? And I think this applies to tutorials a bit more than to seminars. I usually just say, and sometimes this surprises people, I really feel like I come into the classroom and I just hang out with a book, with a text, with a problem, right? I just hang out with like a group of friends trying to understand or kind of like work through a given text problem, something like that, right?
Sure.
So it really doesn't feel like teaching in this kind of like hierarchical model. I think it's even on the St. John's website that a tutor is supposed to be like the best model student in the classroom or something like that, yeah? And it really is true, yeah.
I mean, I'll say the students are terrific. You know, when they start at the college, sometimes they do expect us to have more answers.
Yeah.
And then when we, you know, kind of intentionally withhold some of our own thoughts to make way for them to do their own kind of thinking, they just kind of plunge in with real courage, and they just find how much they figure out by really making a go of it. You know, no one's going to do it for them, and they learn to do it themselves. It's very, very impressive to both of us.
Right. And then when we come into the classroom and when we, not having answers ourselves, right, kind of expect thoughts from them, and we take them seriously as thinkers, it really does something to them too. I think they start taking themselves very seriously.
Sure.
And then often, like, I am kind of shocked and intimidated by just like how thoughtful, you know, many, many of them can be.
Yeah.
You know, noticing something in a text that I've been reading for maybe like a decade and never noticed before. Yeah.
Yeah.
So just to connect the two themes, then, was this method of teaching interrupted, or was it hastened, or was it infected anyway by the remote teaching? Having people talking to each other over Zoom, were they more shy about getting in there, or was it, how'd that change the dynamic?
I think there were a lot of the usual disadvantages that would beset any education that had to move on to Zoom. I'll say a couple of nice moments that I remember that Zoom seemed to facilitate. One was I was teaching a lab class when I first came in, and as you can imagine, a lab class that doesn't take place in a laboratory classroom is severely hampered in certain ways. But what was really nice was the kind of observational biology unit. The students were all over the world.
Yeah.
So they were observing this real biodiversity on Zoom. So you'd have, you know, people, I tell this story all the time, but there was one student who got a quince from the tree in her backyard, and another student who had this beautiful Turkish flower that he brought in that I had never seen before. And it was just much more biodiverse than if we had done this on campus in our own backyard.
The greatest obstacle for me, I was lucky, I think, to not have to do lab during that Zoom year. But for me, the greatest obstacle was, you know, this in math tutorials.
Oh, yeah.
The blackboard was missing. So we had to use these like really weird virtual digital blackboards. And it was kind of a nightmare.
Yeah.
And a constant source of sort of jokes and like awkward situations. And I really do feel like it's not, you know, two characters here in our room, but three really, because I mean, it's a great blackboard.
To people listening, there is a blackboard behind the two of you.
Yeah.
Covered with writings and things and whatnot. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Only on the second attempt, Nicholas was able to bring this blackboard in. I mean, it's kind of a long story, but
yeah.
Imagine transporting a blackboard on the roof of a very small car.
Yeah, right.
And somehow a dangerous endeavor.
And somehow it was always my car that Nicholas would ask to use to transport.
I left that out of the story.
To transport these blackboards that he would find on like Facebook Marketplace, and then we would have to like drive like an hour away to get it. I think this is the first
this
blackboard.
This was delivered, okay.
Right. This was delivered, okay. But the first blackboard, I won't say what happened, but you know, we purchased it. Yeah. We never, you know, we were never able to bring it to Nicholas's
house.
No people
or animals were injured in the transportation.
No one was injured. Not even my car. Yeah, maybe a few scratches, but I forgive you.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this was a problem. Not having a blackboard was a problem on Zoom. But we used something that was, I think, called a Zideboard.
Zideboard. I mean, it's a kind of online whiteboard program. Yeah. I remember there's this story from Renaissance art history or medieval art history where all these artists were competing for a kind of papal contract. And Giotto won the contract because instead of sending a portfolio of work, you know, beautiful sketches and things like that, the Pope's messenger, I think, just if I'm remembering the story correctly, just came to him and said, what sample can I give the Pope? And the Giotto just drew an O freehand. And the circle was so perfect that the Pope just looked at it and said, oh, this guy, we need this guy. And I'll say, if anyone could have drawn a freehand circle of that quality on this online Zideboard program, it would have been even more impressive because it was a total disaster.
Oh, no. Absolutely. And I remember actually, so the year after, right, first year that we were in person, often like circle drawing competitions would happen in my sophomore math that I was teaching at the time. So there's something to it. Yeah. Drawing circles on the blackboard, it's a skill.
How are your blackboard skills, Bill, as a substitute teacher?
Oh, not every teacher has them. The older teachers still love the blackboards. I think they kind of hold on.
Or whiteboard.
Whiteboard. Yeah, I really want to do the dotted line. I don't know if you've seen that on YouTube. There's some professors who can just draw a dotted line. It has to do with how you hold the chalk and your grip and the angle it hits the blackboard at. But it'll skip across the blackboard quite naturally and create a dotted line. It's pretty cool. I can't quite do that. It sounds like a zipper, giant zipper. But I was in a math class a few weeks ago and had a blackboard. And this guy loved math. You can kind of tell when you walk into a classroom. This teacher's been in this room for a while. It is their room. And they love math. And they had some of that expensive Japanese chalk. I forget what it's called now, but there is like this gourmet chalk that is from Japan. I think they make it in Korea now.
I know what that is. Yeah. That's the one I use. It's great.
There we go. It's got a very thin, almost like a wax on the outside, so it doesn't get on your fingers.
Right.
And it erases completely, brilliantly. It goes on and comes off very, very well. And you've got to order it from Japan. And
also available on Amazon. I think that's actually that's exactly the chalk that Nicholas has right there. Since they're not paying us for advertisement, I won't mention the name. No, Hagoroma. I'm actually surprised now that we've been talking about the blackboard for a few minutes that you haven't asked Nicholas to maybe like draw a circle. No, I'm joking.
No. We should be. No, next time.
I'm thinking to start an improv scene. So we do. Have you guys, either of you, ever done improv of any sort before, besides obviously talking, but in a performance setting?
Is it going to sound really stupid if I say at summer camp when I was about 12? That's as much as I can say.
Yeah. Not stupid at all.
And I never have.
Well, Mark, again, first episode, what's the message?
Well, we've already been improvising this whole time. But not as necessarily as characters. The premise of this show is to try to use the improv. We've now dropped a lot of little nuggets, little thought nuggets out in the discussion so far. So without articulating them, can we try to make those feed into the scene that we're about to have? That'll run not more than probably 5 minutes just so to keep the pain to a minimum.
I think we can.
So, Bill, I was thinking, you know, as a substitute teacher, maybe we can be your students for a second.
Sure. We can start that way. Hey, everybody. You got a sub today. Mr. Arnett, nice to meet everybody. Yeah, your teacher left some notes. I'll go ahead and go over these, and we'll do attendance. If you just want to put your phone in the little cubby hole that's assigned to you, then I'll just do attendance that way. I'll just count the phones that are missing.
Excuse me, sir. What is that thing that you just brought in and you put on the wall behind you? What is that thing?
The cubby hole?
No. That big black board that you just put up. What is that?
A chalkboard?
I feel like I should be on the phone right now. No.
Yeah. Just put your phones away, everybody. You're supposed to put your phones away. And it's a chalkboard.
We've never had those.
What? There aren't any around the school? There's no chalkboards around the school? Anybody raise your hand if you've seen a chalkboard before? Anybody?
I've only seen a whiteboard before.
Right.
Yeah,
what is chalk? What is chalk exactly? It's just for sidewalks, right? I mean, it's like bright colors.
This is like a sidewalk. This is like a vertical sidewalk.
How do you walk on it?
Well, what do you think people did before ink, before markers were invented?
Huh? Parchment, I think.
They use chalkboards. I mean, a big thing. I'm not going to hold a huge thing of parchment on the wall. You can erase it. You've seen movies. Come on now. I bet in movies or TV shows you've seen a chalkboard or students having to clap erasers. Nobody.
I always thought those were just whiteboards.
Colored with black marker on them. Sharpie.
Reverse whiteboards.
Right, a reverse whiteboard, right.
Yeah.
I mean, in what sense is chalkboard not a reverse whiteboard? Is it anything more than that?
rather than ink, it's chalk. It's a
sir
calcium carbide. It's a mineral that then soft rock that deposits on the board. We got a question here. Yeah,
sir. Yeah. Are there other colors? Are there blue boards, red boards?
I've seen green before.
Green boards,
but mostly just this kind of slate color.
Well, I actually have a question too.
Yeah.
Now that you said, I mean, if we look at that blackboard, as we've just called it closely, I mean, it's not exactly black. It's green too. So then why do we call, I mean, and in fact, I feel like most blackboards are kind of green, dark green. So why do we call them blackboards?
Okay. So you have seen one. You have seen
and
one.
You are, you
well, we've seen green boards, but you said blackboards. So we were confused.
Why are you referring to this as a blackboard? That's a green board.
It's a catch-all. It's just that that's just the colloquial name. Hmm. Hey, you know what? Let's all let's line up at the front of the class. And we'll hand out some chalk, and everyone can take a turn writing something on the blackboard and erasing it. This is how what school was like when I was a kid. We didn't have dry erase markers.
What do we write?
Anything you want. Anything, go for it. Mark your first. Go for it. Here's a piece of chalk. Write anything you want.
I want to try to do like a skippy line. Like just like...
Okay, yeah.
Oh!
Did you poke your eye out? Did you hit yourself?
I got to sit down. This didn't work.
Okay.
Calling somebody else.
That chalk looks sharp.
It's no sharper than a dry erase marker. All right, you're next. Nick, get up there. Just pretend it's a marker, but it's just not.
Okay. All right. I mean, my handwriting is pretty...
Nicholas, I hope you're wearing pants.
I'm wearing pants. Oh, yeah. No, don't worry. I mean, I dress for school, you know?
Why don't you... Dress circle. Have you ever had this sort of interactive improv before with actions taken on camera?
I usually just hand out the worksheet and that's it, you know, and read a book.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, the thing is, my handwriting is really embarrassing.
I'm going to go ahead and draw a circle.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
He's taking my turn. Is that
and
okay?
I apologize. I'm not wearing pants.
Sure. I'm wearing shorts. Yeah. If you can just grab a piece of chalk.
Here's my circle.
You can't see it. He drew it behind the lamp. Can you draw
that
it?
That was intentional.
Can you? It's a perfect circle. It's actually the most impressive circle I've ever seen.
How was that, Kafiz? Was that amazing? Was that fun?
That was easy.
Cool? It was easy.
That was easy.
Just like a dry erase board,
just the skill,
right?
I possess, yeah.
Yeah. Now, how are we going to make the circle go away?
Throw away the chalkboard?
No.
No? Okay.
It is away right now, but what I can do is I can make it appear and disappear.
Well, you can hold something in front of it, yeah. But, I mean, how would we, if we wanted to draw something else on the blackboard?
Oh, yeah. Do you have something to erase? Okay.
Is the circle the image that's on it? Isn't it something only an image when it reaches an observer? So if it's covered up, there's no circle.
Yeah, I think it has reached you by now. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Through the,
yeah. Okay. Now I'm going to just demonstrate how blackboards work.
Please.
I guess, yeah.
Please.
Or green boards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. That rectangular box. That's right. Now you're just going to wipe it. That kind of. It's like felt. Yeah. If you can. Awesome. Look at that. Yeah. Look at that. Where'd it go? Where'd the image go? Yeah,
tell me when to stop rubbing.
You can stop. You can stop. You're done. Before. You're good. Yeah. Any guesses, anybody, what that kind of cube, that kind of rectangular block of felt is called? Any guesses?
I mean, it's probably some very, like, creative technical term, like the named after its inventor, like the Galileo.
Chalk remover. Oh, the Galileo. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, it didn't.
And the eraser. It's an eraser.
Well, that's not very creative.
Like the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think.
Is it named after the movie?
But, I mean, you guys have seen dry erase board erasers, right?
I mean, usually you just use your arm.
Well, yeah, but then you get ink on your arm.
I mean, yeah, and I wonder why teachers do that. And then they sniff the markers.
If not the listeners and the viewers, I've got a cardigan that's just like perfect for that.
Yeah, he's got a black cardigan for the blackboard.
Well, yeah, well, then you're going to get chalk dust on your sweater.
Yeah, but you see, he's dressed black and white themed, so it's actually perfect. I mean, it'll just add to the look, I think.
That's fine.
And if you're a teacher, you have to be prepared for it.
I'm dressed for a blue board, but he's dressed for a blackboard. Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as a footnote, I think, you know, my favorite part about this improv is that if this is the first time we see the blackboard, then that means that as a sub-teacher, you bring the blackboard with you every time you're teaching. That's some commitment.
Like a traveling blackboard salesman.
And again, this is maybe not for the listeners, but for the viewers, that is not a very light blackboard. So, you know, chapeau.
I just want to try the eraser.
Can you try the eraser?
We'll pass it to you. Yeah.
Reach through.
There we go.
And
you put it in your eye again, Mark. You literally shoved it into your eye.
Wow.
This is no different than a dry erase board. This is no different. It's the same principle. In fact, I would say that the people who invented dry erase boards were trying to improve on the blackboard. It's The same family tree.
Mark, this is why the regular teacher makes you put those rubber things on the end of the pencils. You're a hopeless cause, Mark. I'm sorry.
It's just, as I know, I'm one of the zoomies, so I'm in a two-dimensional space. And so when I move something right to left through my eye line, it's going to go into an eye. There's no other choice. It's a two-dimensional space. I guess I am actually in the room with you. It's just I'm so used to being on Zoom that I still carry those scars.
Yeah.
This is just one of those pernicious effects of Zoom on education.
Yeah. You know? So many eye injuries.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, Nicholas, are you ready to write something on the blackboard? It's your turn. Or do you feel confident? Oh. We've seen several people do it.
Gosh, I don't know. Yeah. Well, what would I write?
I love how much Nicholas is hesitating, because I think at this point, like, many listeners and viewers would start thinking maybe he's not wearing pants.
I am wearing pants, but the truth is that I've never used a chalkboard before, and I'm a little worried about, you know, I have a little bit of stage fright here. So I don't know, like, can you say some words of encouragement or something?
Give him a prompt.
You can do it.
That didn't sound very convincing.
You can do it? That's what they taught you at teacher's college? You can do it?
Technically, you can do it.
You know, the teacher's college, we kind of have to tailor our commentary to the level of need here. There is nothing difficult or profound or unique or singular about writing on a chalkboard. I think you can do it is the most technical description that I could possibly give.
I'm just worried because of the eye injury I witnessed.
Here's an encouragement from me. No one cannot not do it.
Well, that's
a triple negative.
I think we showed that Nicholas and Kafiz are in a three-dimensional space, so you probably won't have the same issue.
I think you will hold the chalk as you would a pencil.
Okay.
Press it firmly, yet not too hard, against the board, and drag it across the board, down.
Yeah, it's not working.
Well, you have to push it against the board. Push it until it makes contact, all the way. It's going to make contact.
I thought we were in a two-dimensional space here. I'm sorry. This doesn't make sense to me.
You're in a three-dimensional space.
We're
not on Zoom anymore. That was several years ago. We're off Zoom. Push it against. Awesome. Now drag it down. Yay, there it is. Look at that. You made a line.
Hey, okay. That was not as bad as I thought it was going to be. Thank you.
It's not as great as my circle, but
this is very conceptually similar to pens and pencils on paper. Let me just say that.
How so?
You're rubbing something across a surface, leaving a mark.
Yeah.
Depositing pencil lead or depositing chalk on a surface. This is very similar.
If paper's on a surface that's down in front of you, so if you want to do, he just did a nice line down, like showing the downward slope of the economy, the downward trajectory of history, and you can't do that on a piece of paper.
Education in America.
You could do a line toward yourself. It's like, hey, it's more about me, but you can't go down. It goes right through the paper. It just rips a hole in it. I tried it.
Tape the paper on the wall. Get a thumbtack. Put it on the wall. Look, you we're thinking about this a lot, everybody. I still haven't done attendance yet. All right. And last time I checked, this is an English class. We're getting very theoretical and very. Are we good, everybody? Are we confident now that a blackboard is just a different medium to write with?
I think we've succeeded in spending the entirety of the class so you could not get started, which is, of course, what we do with every sub. Ha-ha.
That was the plan all along. Well, yeah, touche. Yeah. Touche. You did it.
Yeah, but this was like the best AP English class we've had all year.
Thank you very much. Feel free to let my boss know.
This was longer than five minutes.
Yeah. Well, let's say it's done. Let's say that's over.
Right. We can be done. But, yes.
Let's stop for a second. Let's clarify. Why do we have an episode releasing today when we just had one releasing last week? That's crazy. It's like the days where we started this podcast. Well, it's because we actually have advertisers. The first of which is Bazigo Iris, your smart home mosquito detector. Now, I'm guessing that you don't like mosquito bites. They are not just annoying. These little suckers can carry nasty diseases. Well, the Bazigo Iris is a cutting-edge device that uses computer vision and AI to detect, track, and pinpoint mosquitoes in real time. So there's no more guessing, no more swatting at thin air, just a simple, precise way to take control of your space. So you plug it in next to your bed. You plug it in next to your child's bed. You take it on vacation with you at the hotel in the mosquito-infested land you're visiting. The Bazigo Iris is the eye. It's going to scan the vicinity with its advanced computer vision system 24/7, even in complete darkness. And when it detects a mosquito, a little laser is going to show you exactly where it is. It circles round and round that little sucker, and the Bazigo can send an alert to your phone. So if you're not in the room at the time, you can know, hey, there's a mosquito going on there. When you go up there, you can thwack it in one of the traditional ways, or better yet, pair your iris with the Bazigo swatter, which you just hold up to wherever the laser is indicating, and you electrocute the little sucker. So stop losing sleep over mosquitoes. Take back your nights with Bazigo. Go to bazigo.com/discount/buzz10 to save 10% off. That's bazigo.com/discount/buzz10 and use the code buzz10 to get 10% off. Say goodbye to itchy bites and sleepless nights. Thank you, Bazigo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's show is also brought to you by our sponsor, Surfshark VPN. You should be worried about your internet security, identity theft, fraud, people trying to spy on your data, especially if you're at a hotel, at a coffee shop. The Surfshark Virtual Private Network will shield your data on public Wi-Fi and, of course, from your home with military-grade encryption. I have Surfshark right now on my laptop, on my phone, on my tablet. It was very easy to set up. It's very simple to turn on and off. So you choose to have the device connect to a server, and then all your internet traffic will go through that server. So anyone trying to track you is just going to see the location of that server. That's where they're going to think you are. And I have noticed no slowdown in anything. In fact, one of the great things this is useful for is watching online video that's only available in other countries. So there's going to be different stuff on Netflix if it thinks you're in the UK. I was using it to watch the Canadian version of the show Traitors, which they do not allow anybody in the U.S. to see normally. So, Surfshark VPN, you'll get a secure, unrestricted internet experience. It's time to take control of your online security. Try Surfshark risk-free today and enjoy their 30-day money-back guarantee. Go to surfshark.com/improv for 4 extra months of Surfshark. That's code improv at surfshark.com. And you don't have to remember that. The URL and code can be found in our show notes.
And as a concluding footnote, we really, I think on Annapolis campus, we don't have a single whiteboard. It's all blackboards.
Wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I don't know. Can I tell a story now?
Yes, or please.
Oh, please. Yeah.
So the love of blackboards and their kind of traditional feel is such at our school, and I share this myself, by the way, that I once made the mistake when I started in 2020 of saying, can I just get a whiteboard so I can teach on Zoom at home and have a little hand whiteboard.
Yeah.
The colleague I asked at the time just wrote back to me and said, I don't understand. Why would you ever want a whiteboard? And I just meant like generically a whiteboard or a blackboard or something like that. But he sent me a very long email just like detailing the advantages of blackboards and really trying to persuade me that a whiteboard would be a huge mistake. And I was like, yeah, I'm convinced. Okay. I'll get a blackboard.
Uh-huh. Well, so this improv was like very appropriate.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Intuited. Yeah.
You know, blackboards, I'm almost tempted to start calling them Johnny boards, you know, in the model of, we have Johnny chairs, which are these, you know, which are these beautiful wooden chairs, which are, I think they're made somewhere in Virginia, that are well, almost the only kind of chair that is used on campus in Annapolis and in Santa Fe. And so maybe now we start calling those Johnny boards. It's more accurate than calling them blackboards, given that most of them are dark green anyway. So that's just completely
just
inaccurate.
Just really rubbing that in, that point.
That was the intention, yeah.
We can all agree that blackboards, green boards, dry erase boards are all categorically
Johnny boards.
They're all better than overhead projectors and transparencies. We can agree that that's true.
I mean, the days of overhead projectors and transparencies, those were pretty cool. I never got to do that as a teacher.
I had one art history professor in college who still used those amazing old slides, the slide wheels.
Oh, and, a slide projector. Yeah. The carousel.
You know, for me at the time, it was in 2012. It was a real vintage experience. I loved it.
Oh, yeah. I had a professor like that in graduate school. He would simply just project pages from his own copy of the book. This was a seminar Bergson or Bergson. And I remember the highlight for me of the whole experience was that he would project these pages from like his own copy, right? And then everything would be underlined. And so I remember like a friend of mine just like leans in and is like, he's like, Hafiz, do you think that what's important is like what's not underlined?
Yeah. It's so underlined that there's more underlined than not underlined. Yes.
So I guess, yes, you could just put a book on there and have it project. I also remember them printing out these clear like, here's my handout. But I, you know, it's not just a piece of white paper. It's a piece of clear paper that I guess was done in a special printer. Am I hallucinating this? This was a thing, right?
I never got to hand it out to us.
No. I mean that they would put on the projector so that the light would show through it so that it shows up. Yeah, it's a transparency. And so they could then use their little marker and write on the transparency in a way that you probably wouldn't in real time on your book. Apparently this professor, it looked like the book was full, that they could not add anything to it.
Well, it was so disturbing. A, the overhead projectors, they would often not project perfectly square on the screen. So things would be slightly distorted. And that would kind of get me, I don't think I'm OCD, but it would kind of get me a little bit, like I could not see the imperfections in the image. And then they would lean over it and the light would make their face like they had these very prominent eyebrows. And this, it was like, you know, a horror movie, this underlighting, you know, you'd see Dracula with the light beneath them. And it gave them this very severe facial expression as they're up there trying to teach us chemistry or something. And it was small. It was a square, you know, the aspect ratio was kind of very squarish. And you couldn't, they only had one machine, so they couldn't have other stuff. You know, the dry erase, you'd have a whole wall of dry erase boards or blackboards. And then the cantilevered ones that slide up and down, you know, the whole.
Yeah, I forgot about this element of it, that it's like a Star Wars scroll of making the transparency proceed to the next slide in that it's a section of this the scroll that has been.
So I'm glad that's all gone. I'm glad that's all taken the past.
I don't recall interacting or seeing what the machine that made the scrolls looked like. It was just a weird kind of Xerox sort of.
Although, I mean, in defense of cantilevers, is that what you call? I am a big fan of, like, in cars. Uh-huh. When you have to open the window, you have to, like...
Oh, crank it?
You have to crank it. Yeah, I think that's something that I miss constantly in, like, modern cars. You just have to press the button. It just doesn't make me feel as powerful as I would be if I had to just, like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
I also prefer cars that you have to do that with, like pedal boats, you know, but cars. Like, you know, no engines, but just...
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. That's deep path. Yeah.
You got to start the car by getting out and cranking it and then jump in really fast, like a bike plane.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Definitely that scene, a lot of more philosophy came out of that. What is the theme that we've stumbled on? Have we successfully stumbled on a theme? Educational technologies. I mean, that's a thing. Mm-hmm. I think we've talked about before, Bill, right? Did I tell you how Plato, he didn't like those newfangled books, or at least Socrates, right? Because once you write something down, it's dead. You got to be talking to each other. It's got to be alive. The same complaints that people had about computers or any advance in anything.
Sure.
So you must be referring to Phaedrus, right? Which is, I mean, I guess like one way to read the dialogue is, at least in part, Plato's critique of writing and technology more broadly, which is, again, I mean, let me just mention another thing about St. John, since this has also been that's where we both work. The only Platonic dialogue, the only text that is read twice at St. John's, so it's read sort of towards the end of the freshman year.
I think it's the last reading of both freshman year and senior year.
Right. So the last reading of both freshman year and senior year, right? But it's a little bit ironic, no, that the text that is read twice at St. John's, which is a great books school, a great books program, is in large part a critique of books, a critique of writing. Right?
Yeah.
The program is sometimes I feel like the program is full of these subtle ironies. Jokes and ironies.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that's still writing is the preferred manner in which academic professionalism is displayed, but yet it seems like St. John's has given, I don't know if the spirit is, I'm trying to get at whether the spirit of that open discussion as we've been talking about is conducive, led you to doing a podcast and the format in which you do it. We have not mentioned it yet. Invasive Thoughts. What, five episodes, six episodes? You're barely off the ground.
We just released our fifth episode, today. One thing to say is we commute to work very often together. We have similar schedules.
And we both live in Baltimore. And so we ask, in fact, for similar schedules so that we can commute together.
Yeah. Yeah.
We live about 5 minutes away from each other by car. So it's quite convenient. Yeah.
And this is has been intellectually very stimulating. I mean, you can imagine, you know, we talk about what's on our mind in the car, and a number of times a week we had these 45, 50 minute conversations, and we just became very comfortable talking about ideas together. And of course, much of our job is about having conversations about books. So it just seemed like a natural outgrowth at a certain point. And also the program is full at St. John's is full of these wonderful books categorized as great books. But there are lots of books, of course, that aren't on the program that are worth discussing. So we just thought it just seemed like a kind of natural outgrowth of what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think another element here is that we have, you know, very different backgrounds, sort of like pre-St. John's, right? So I did my graduate work in philosophy.
I did kind of history, art history, classics, English Renaissance literature. So I was, I was kind of more like eclectic than Hafiz, who was very thoroughly trained in philosophy.
So part of our kind of friendship, collegial friendship, right? I mean, we're both friends and colleagues, I think, is kind of like sharing these things, right, with each other, which has always been a lot of fun. I mean, sometimes intimidating. I mean, Nicholas is someone who gets Kant's first critique on the first reading. I mean, it's kind of scary.
I want that on my tombstone, by the way.
I understood it.
Except I would want it on my tombstone, except that Kant tells me I shouldn't lie. So, you know.
Yeah, Nicholas, do you want to say a few things about the name, Why Invasive Thoughts?
Why Invasive Thoughts?
Why Invasive Thoughts? Why did we name it Invasive Thoughts?
I mean, is it because Nicholas's voice sounds like it's right in your brain?
Oh, does it? Oh, wow.
I think in particular, it's a very good kind of NPR.
Hey, I'll take that.
Calm. Yeah.
Oh, I am, Mark, I'm so glad you said that, because this is what I've been telling him. And Nicholas would like not believe me that I feel like he has like the perfect podcast voice.
He started our last, we just released our fifth episode on an Agamben book. And he starts the podcast by saying this, and it really threw me off. And I mean, you can't see this because it's audio only, but I really made a face at him when he said this. So, you know, but yeah, no, I mean, the answer you just gave, I think I'll say yes to that instead of the real reason, which
is... Well, what is the real reason? Well, let me just say, I mean, here's another possible reason. This is maybe on a somewhat more serious note. And that's something we talk about a little bit in our latest episode that we just uploaded on Agamben, is my favorite definition of philosophy comes from Nietzsche's, I think, Beyond Good and Evil. It's either Beyond Good and Evil or Genealogy of Morals, but I think it's Beyond Good and Evil, where he says something like, maybe you'll remember this. He says something like, oh, like philosophy is really just this like habit of enjoying the arrival of thoughts. It's always just struck me as like very true. And one of the things that I think is really, really true about it is just, you know, thinking or thoughts, it's not something that we can like control, right? Thoughts arrive. So there's a kind of a degree of passivity to thinking, to the arrival of thoughts, like they arrive as, you know, visitors, so to speak. And maybe, I mean, in part, I think, even if this was not part of our explicit like deliberation when we were thinking of what to name the podcast, but I think at least unconsciously, right, part of our name is just a kind of a play on this passivity of thought, right? But we try to emphasize it or kind of highlight it in a slightly more interesting, provocative way.
Yeah.
And it's a podcast, right? So it's a conversation.
Yeah.
And I think one of the best ways to kind of like, if not accelerate or provoke this arrival of thoughts, especially, you know, thoughts, surprising thoughts, thoughts that, you know, one might have not expected to have, which is really, I think, the best kinds of thought. That happens in a conversation.
Yeah.
Right? So this is, okay. So this would be like a kind of a slightly more serious gloss on what invasive thoughts means. Yeah.
Would you say that by that definition, all thoughts are invasive?
The best ones are, yeah.
The idea that you if they're all come to us as visitors, if they're all somewhat intrusive, is it possible to have a non-invasive thought?
I think my just immediate reaction to that is that they feel more invasive. That is to say, you notice the invasion more when you sort of have to step back and ask yourself, where did that thought come from? Like, that's an unfamiliar thought. It's not something I've read or heard before. Mm-hmm. It's not a direct repetition or variation on what I've just heard from Hafiz or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
I know it has been a recurrent point in several philosophy discussions that I've had recorded here that I think people think that they have more control over their thoughts than they do. That, you know, I'm setting out to do something, I'm gathering a list or something, but we never see where the sources of the thoughts come. You might think I'm willing the next thought to come or something, but that's not really our experience. But still, of course, we have thoughts that we find ourselves having and thoughts that are at least relevant to what we're doing, so that we've set the stage and invited the thoughts. Invasive, but still passive.
Or open ourselves, put ourselves in a situation where we will allow the environment, what we're doing, to enter into us and affect us. And that effect is manifests itself as thoughts.
Yeah, I really like this because I think, you know, part of what it means to think is really consists in that kind of a preparatory work, right? As you've just described it, Bill, sort of assuming or adopting a kind of an attitude of welcoming thoughts, right? So maybe ideally, like, no thought feels uninvited when one is really thinking. On the opposite sort of side of this issue, let me put it in a slightly more provocative ways. I mean, if the thought that I'm having is not surprising me, right? Does not feel at all intrusive. Then it feels like I'm just thinking like along rails. Mm-hmm. And then is it really even thinking, right? Or is it some kind of like execution of habit, right?
Yeah. I was just on Sunday running a workshop for an improv group, and they were getting a show together for what this thing they were doing. And there was they were going to have kind of a set piece at the beginning of the show, an opening kind of a thing, this word association kind of a thing that they would do at the beginning of the show to kind of get their thing going. And they kind of described what it would be, and they wanted some help with it. Like we think it could be a little sharper. It's difficult in some places. Audiences don't react the way we would like them to. Could you look at it? And again, it's like we can talk about it, and I can kind of imagine what it might be. And I kind of had some thoughts as they were described. But once I saw it and was like, I need to look at this thing for what it is, and did it feel long? Did it feel draggy? And it's just that whole thing of like you setting the table for thoughts. And I don't know where or how or what those thoughts are. You talk about it being, I've never seen what they're about to do. It is completely brand new to me. But being open to it, there is a moment, and this doesn't sound snotty or anything, but I'm sure during discussions or things, you also put yourself in that position. I need to understand what this person is going for. What they tell me, what they give me, may not be exactly what their thoughts are. We are imperfect. We can't necessarily turn our ideas into reality one-to-one the way we imagine them. And they're our imaginations anyway. They're not real. But yeah, I imagine in discussions and things, there is a mindset of like, I need to withhold my thoughts, my conscious thoughts, and kind of let what they're saying hit and allow my brain to start spitting stuff out. Yeah, I don't know.
Active listening instead of,
to allow thinking to occur. Yeah.
Just two quick responses to that. One is, I think, can't we always tell when we're talking to someone and they have like a thing that they're waiting to say as opposed to actually listening to what we're saying?
Yeah.
The other thing is just kind of tangentially, I was thinking about once or twice at when we started Invasive Thoughts, we were just figuring things out and there was some kind of audio snafu, like the audio didn't sound as sharp as it should have, or I think it sounded too sharp.
Yeah. No.
And we would like try and re-record a segment, and invariably if we tried to re-record it in exactly the same way, it was just flat and dead. And so we always had to kind of really do it afresh. I mean, there's something that's just like unmistakable about the stale.
Yeah. I still think that, again, I'm probably not a good judge of this, but I think the best episode that we've recorded ever was the one that we sort of screwed up a little. And so we were never able to like restore the audio to make it comfortably listenable. So we'll never publish it, but and then we tried to do it again and it didn't turn out, as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and I won't tell you
the
which episode it is, but that lost episode, man, like it was great. Yeah.
There's only one Partially Examined Life episode, full hour and a half, 2 hour discussion that just got lost completely. And we even had a guest on it. We just had another discussion about the same topic and it was very different. And in fact, we sort of had our thoughts together more because we got to practice it once. Mm-hmm. I did want to ask about your format that, we're basically teaching the text. We've read the text. Let's talk about the things we found interesting in the text. We could probably do that any number of times, but what are you even doing to prepare? Are you reading the same text? Are you kind of coming in with your background knowledge, or you decide on the topic and then prep however you'd like?
We've done it a couple different ways, and I think we're open to doing it in various ways. So that is to say, I don't think there's a fixed format, but often we'll read the same text. There was one episode, Goethe and Hegel, Goethe's Gardener, it's called, where one of us came in kind of with more thought. Well, I guess you came in with more explicit questions about Hegel and I came in with more explicit questions about Goethe. And then we sort of worked on it that way. But often we'll come in having read the same book. Often it's a book that one of us has read before and the other one has not. And one of us has recommended it to the other. And then, sometimes we don't even decide in advance, like who's going to start off. And we try and I think keep it as informal as possible so that we don't have expectations that kind of suck the life out of the conversation. So our hope is that the spontaneity comes through. But in general, I think we do find that a lot of the things that Hafiz found interesting in his reading, I also found interesting in the reading. And so like the notes we take, overlap a lot, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mentioned sharing before. I mean, this is, I think, a big part for me. I think for both of us, really. I think before we started the podcast, like, over the kind of years of our friendship, I have shared, sometimes even myself, bought like a few books that I thought were really cool. Agamben's The Open, Man and Animal, which is the episode that we just published. Right. Yeah. I think I got you that book like 2 years ago or something like that. And then, I mean, Kentan Miyasu's After Finitude, right, which is this just kind of a really spectacular kind of speculative argument.
That's
I mean, so much fun. I don't necessarily agree with it, but it's just so much fun to read. And so these are the kinds of books that I like recommend to Nicholas, and then Nicholas recommends books to me, but somehow, and I'll be frank here, until we started the podcast, like, it'd be very rare that, say, I recommend the book to Nicholas, he actually picks it up and reads it. So this podcast kind of like forces us to actually take each other's recommendations seriously and read them together.
Yeah.
Let me just also add about the Hegel episode. What I thought was really funny is that, you know, because my background is in philosophy, and Hegel is one of those figures that I studied a little more than others, that was probably for me like the most difficult episode to do because I had like too many answers, and everything I would say, like words just wouldn't come to me. And then every time I would say something about Hegel, I would immediately think, oh, like this is so stupid, like, and wrong, right? It's easier, surprisingly, you know, let us know like how it is for you, but it's like easier sometimes to talk about the things that you've only encountered very recently.
Yeah.
And like one feels so much less pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I had thought I'd heard of Giorgio Agamben in some, despite never having read any of him. And it was because at the bottom of his wiki page, I see they're talking about him dismissing COVID is not that big a deal. I think that there was articles to that effect that
That was a kind of a, I think, a fairly temporary like setback or kind of a blow to his reputation. I think he was very much one of the very, very few kind of living active European continental philosophers who around, I mean, we started this discussion, you know, with COVID, around 2020, 2021, he published like a few articles where he was basically a kind of like a soft anti-vaxxer, is anti-masker a term?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So
now,
he was both of those. Yeah, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so that was a bit of a blow of his reputation. But he's still such an interesting and great thinker. And I can sort of see where he's coming from with his suspicion of things like math and vaccines, right? He had spent decades writing about biopolitics.
Mm-hmm.
The book that we're discussing in our newest episode, The Open, is sort of Agamben's reflections on how the history of philosophy has been, for in large part, a kind of a history of humanity's attempts to distance themselves from animals, to sort of show how we humans are different from animals.
Okay.
But another thing that Agamben works on is biopolitics, right, which comes from Foucault, which is this idea that increasingly, or like throughout history, governments would kind of interfere and sort of would politically dictate what we do with our bodies more and more. So it's, I mean, in a certain way, I wasn't surprised that Agamben took like a very kind of a strong position on those things. Although, I mean, like I said, he met with some counter arguments. Another living, active European philosopher who I think they're friends, Jean-Luc Nancy, which, I mean, he wrote a few essays kind of against Agamben's position very strongly. But yeah, he's worth reading.
I think he's one of the better known European public intellectuals, right? Which is a category that we, I think, have less of in the United States. I mean, people who are known for their serious academic work, but mm-hmm. also weigh in, you know, serious academic work, not in sort of public policy fields, mm-hmm. But in the humanities, say,
yeah,
but also
well, yeah.
weigh in on contemporary political debates.
Now I'm kind of regretting that we haven't tackled this Agamben's anti-vaxxer position in our podcast. That would have
next
created
season.
More buzz, right? This is it's those are the kinds of hot topics you want to talk about, right?
Right, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Bonus episode.
Well, this is why I've had you all come in for this sort of special faculty meeting with just the three of you, because there have been complaints about your quoting famous philosophers just to say things that are politically incorrect. That just because you put it in quotes, like saying, you're wearing a mask, what a pussy, and saying that's Agamben. That's not okay.
Right. He would have said it in Italian, though. Yeah.
It's a quote. I mean, it's a quote. Are you saying it's not a quote? Are you saying that we haven't been using quotes? Because we've been using quotes. They're cited.
Is it a quote?
You're familiar with the use-mention distinction, right?
Use-mention?
Yes, that if you...
Yeah, we are philosophy professors. Why don't you, administrator, you educate us on what the use-mention...
Use-mention... So if you're
mention,
saying, Agamben believed this thing, and then you clearly quote it, but if you say, as Agamben would say, screw you, like, that's not okay. That's not okay. That's because that's you actually still using it toward a student. And we've get comments about this from all three of your students are fed up. I mean, we're getting pressure from the higher ups. We're getting pressure from the parents. We're getting pressure from the government. You can't do this. You can't be abusive to students.
I mean, can I just say, I'm surprised, actually, this sounds like it would be the least of my students' complaints. I mean, given that I can't even draw on a chalkboard, it seems like this is just nothing compared to that. So, you know, yeah. Come back at me when you've got a little more of a case, I would say.
Let me just look through the report. Okay, so I did have a report from your class that you tried to write on the chalkboard, and it was something like, as Nietzsche would say, and then you tried to like draw eternal recurrence, and you just kind of kept swirling and were looking more and more aggravated. And then you threw the chalk out into the classroom. And you thought that was good education?
I would argue that's a perfect representation of the eternal recurrence.
It's a hard thought to bear.
So is it that you're getting too personally attached to these philosophers? You're getting too emotionally affected by...
If you want to accuse us of being too emotional and too attached and trying to insert some political agenda into the classroom and, you know, misusing quotes and things for our own benefit, let me just say that's kind of how the world works. So let's prep these kids now.
Mm-hmm. If it's in the advantage of life, I think misuse of quotes is totally okay.
Mr. Arnett, you're a math teacher, so I don't even know why you're quoting Agamben at them. And I don't even think that all these quotes are right. I mean, so as Vico said, you will not get an A in this class no matter how hard you try. I don't think that's a real...
Oh, Vico is a famous, famous hard trader. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure he said it at some point. Maybe it's not in his collected works, but maybe it's in a private letter somewhere or, you know, a phone call to his wife. I don't know.
Yeah, unpublished correspondence.
Yeah.
That's what we always say in the biz. Yeah.
So why are all three of you doing this? This seems like a very weird thing. Do you have a little club? Is it because you've been driving to school together?
All three of us.
Yes. I heard that. Yes. That and so this is how these things start, that you're like, oh, I've got a new burn for the students. You can look at a blonde-haired student. This is one of the quotes that was written down. It was like, your hair looks like it is on fire, like your grades, as Descartes said. Right. That's definitely not a Descartes quote. That's bullshit.
Mr. Dean, let me just say this. You're familiar with the alt-right.
Yes.
And all that that represents, and manipulation and trying to, you know, cherry-picking data, all this.
As you know, the school team was named Pepe the Frog, and we had to change that because of the terrible associations.
We're trying to give an alternative to the alt-right. It's alt-alt-right.
Mm.
Think about it. Think about it.
That's like putting something in like double square quotes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I should also say, you know, Mr. Dean, more often than not, it's our students who comment on our hair, not the other way around, and about our
losing it. Which is uncool, because some of us are, it's pretty uncool.
Well, I thought this hair comment was pretty clearly an improv, because it's not good. I mean, if you're going to do these sick burns, like, you should actually at least plan them out. Like, that one did not sound...
Well, I'll say, you know, our burns were better when we took a car, but since it became the three of us commuting, we've actually been able to all chip in and get a helicopter to school. And it's much, much harder, okay, with all the noise of the chopper. It's much, much harder,
right,
okay?
Right.
Well, so, go back to my, you know, 2023 student evaluations. You'll see. I mean, the burns are pretty sick.
Right. I'm also intrigued that, I mean, I didn't know that Bill was commuting with us the whole time. Where were you hiding, Bill?
In
the trunk?
Yeah.
Oh, did I have wrong information? Were you not commuting with them?
Whispering in your ears. Mr. Arnett? I was there. But am I there? Let's get philosophical. What is there? Who is there? There?
Where is there?
Where is there? Because there's over there, but there's also there. They're different, but they're the same.
Okay. So I see
they're both there.
I see what's going on here, because a couple students have accused each of you, this is not a unique thing to any one of you, of just pretending that they're not there for the whole semester, where they'll like raise their hand. You'll never call on them. You'll say, how many students are here? And you'll count really loudly and conspicuously skip over their chair. What could a student do that would give you this kind of wrath that you would, I mean, this is a very serious social harm you're doing to these students.
Mr. Dean, I'm afraid that you might be an imposter, because there is no hand raising at St. John's. Mm. We don't raise hands in the classroom. I don't know where you got that report.
Maybe from Agamben.
Wow, you're an imposter. I guess we did figure out what's going on.
Oh,
there's
you're
no
using
other
your sick
possible
burns.
Solution other than you being an imposter.
All right, well.
That's the only logical conclusion.
Okay, I see this again. I've at least one notice from a student saying that you've accused them of being an imposter, that you call them by their name and they say, I'm here. And you say, that's not John Smith. I don't even want to use their real names, Because I'm just not sure where this ends. So what? How does this feed into this alt-right ideology?
I call them an imposter if they introduce themselves by their first name, because, you know, we have to use honorifics on campus. So
I feel like Mr. Karamov, you know, I would address him in seminar.
And this is Mr. Bellinson. Mm.
So again, I'm afraid your information doesn't check out.
Yeah. There's a way we do things here, okay? And we need to do it
that way. We have our ways.
We have our ways, and we have to respect the traditions, the ideologies, the things that got us here.
Okay, well, this is not actually something that's abusive to the students, but I know, Mr. Arnett, that you have been saying, like, Mr. Cosine, that you've been taking this Mr. and Ms. thing, and you've been assigning genders to mathematical constructs in a way that I think that could actually be offensive, because most of them are male. Why would you assume that an anthropomorphic mathematical symbol is male? And the ones that are female, it's like, it's only special, like Mrs. Long Division. Like, what's that about? Is that about your personal life?
First of all, let's just all agree that in the Romance languages, all the mathematical functions have a gender. So it's not that crazy to assign gendered nouns, okay? It's happening all over the world in Spanish and French and Italian, okay? And they've all got a gender. Let's start there, okay?
All right. I mean, yeah, we do have Mrs. Biblioteca. It actually says that on the sign above the library. Yeah. So I guess I see where you're
library
going.
Library is a chick.
Yeah. Please keep in mind that Mr. Arnett teaches mathematics in the Romance Languages and Literatures department. So I think he's on solid ground here.
All right. Well, forget about that one. But the rest of them, it would be nice if it would stop. That's the presidential command that we got.
Imposter.
It would be nice if it would stop or all your funding goes away.
We'll take it under advisement.
Okay. That's enough of that. That's
all right.
So now you're much better teachers because you've gone through this experience.
I think yes. So. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're a much better dean.
Yeah. We're all
better for the experience.
That's why they kept me out of academia. Not because they didn't want me teaching students. They just didn't want me to become a dean eventually.
It happens to everyone.
We got to cut this guy off at the knees. He's going to be president one of these days. We got to stop that from happening.
Zoom has already done that.
Oh.
This is probably a whole other can of worms, but there is that kind of, certainly in the last 5, 10, 15 years, academia all of a sudden not being allowed to just say, we're in the pursuit of pure education. And that some people with political motivations trying to get in the way of that. On either side, perhaps, you could argue, of either inclusiveness of people or inclusiveness of ideas. Now, suddenly, academia can't just be, no, we're pure science, we're pure. That doesn't cut it anymore. This is a whole other episode, isn't it? This is a whole other, let's not even go there. But I think it does bring up that, Mark. You did kind of open up that door.
Maybe we can go there for just one second to say, I mean, it is a really interesting, concerning in many ways, but also just philosophically interesting moment in the history of American education right now. And I think, as you say, it's a whole other episode, but we could talk for a long time about the way that trends in higher education have done a lot to, I think, fragment the American academy. And now there are some real serious consequences attached to that. This is not to blame academia for its own problems, but I mean, I think that would be an interesting conversation to have.
Yeah.
It does seem like maybe the whole tutor system came out of these critiques of teachers who are like, you know, you're calling on men more than women. You know what? Fine. I just won't even talk to them. Just make them talk. I'll just ask one question. I'll just sit there. So it was actually the founder of St. John's was a sullen.
There is
was a surly.
Yeah. There are as many an elementary school teacher who has a plastic cup with popsicle sticks, each one with a student's name on it. And as they pull one out to ask them a question, they throw it in a different one into the discard cup. And they'll ask all the students to see equal number of questions. And then at the end of the week, you know, they'll swap cups. You know what I'm saying? I've seen that in many classrooms.
That's news to me.
Yep. Make sure everybody gets called on the same number of times.
I mean, with it being freeform, does that mean that you get the sweat hog effect, which is what happened in our first scene, that only three students apparently talked? Or you are good at least, hey, let's ask Quiet Bill something.
Well, we like to keep classes small. Three students is fine.
Fair enough. Okay. You can't hide.
I had a seminar in the fall. I mean, it was on Kant, so it's not surprising. I only had 7 students. Plus me, the 8th student.
Sure.
But I think one of the main things that the education we offer does is cultivates courage in students. So over the time that they're there, they really not 100% of them, but many of them really just, you know, at a certain point, they realize that if they don't talk, they're missing out, and they just dive in.
Mm-hmm. I think that's
the
hope,
and that's for the most part the reality.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's fantastic.
And they have to talk even about things like math, which is not to mention that, I mean, this is, I think, one of the chief ways that St. John's requires a great deal of courage from its students is they have to do 4 years of math. All of
them,
right? Mm-hmm. There's no getting out of that. So,
yeah.
If only Clarence Thomas had gone to St. John's, then he would not be known as the one who just sits there and doesn't say anything.
And can't draw a circle to save his life. That's the most damning part of his reputation, I think.
Might have went back to not saying anything and just not thinking anything or writing anything too. Just double down on him not doing anything. I think that
Did you have any final thoughts, Bill, on the character and quality of the improv that has gone on here today?
No final thoughts. I enjoyed it, everybody. Ooh. But Mark threw us in there, and you all rolled with it. You know what I'm saying? The scenes can start out of nothing, and there they are. Mm-hmm. Not like life. You know, we don't know what the next scene is going to be. There's going to be a knock at the door, phone call. Who knows? Walk into the doctor's office for a regular checkup and nothing with us, but who knows what's going to happen when we get in there. But we're ready. We got it. We can do this. We're courageous.
Absolutely.
Well, instead of final thoughts, how about invasive thoughts?
Oh, yeah.
Any invasive thoughts to share? Those that maybe arrived during the episode?
I mean, I just pushed my mute button and I just let them...
Sighed. Swear to you under your breath. Yeah.
By the way, sighing, I think, is a very effective pedagogical tool. You know, if you really want to let students know that the class is going well, you just kind of a long sigh.
Yeah.
More of this.
Fortunately, I don't have to use that very often.
When a discussion is going in circles and seems like it will never end.
The eternal recurrence.
The clock ends it. And thus the clock ends our discussion. Thanks so much. But listeners can hear much more of these two gentlemen on the Invasive Thoughts podcast. Maybe they'll get up to episode 10. Maybe we caught you on the inception of something that will reach episode 100, 1,000 perhaps.
That's our hope.
Yeah. And we encourage listeners to keep listening to the Partially Examined Life podcast. I mean, it's really like a kingdom of podcasts. You have so many sort of like
institution
branches to it. It's really, I mean, it's really amazing and impressive. Yeah.
Well, it's fantastic meeting you guys and cool stuff. And maybe try to record an episode in the car. Try to capture that magic. Bring your gear in the car.
It's so funny you say that. We've thought about that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
But, I mean, we're a little worried about the sound quality because, like, even this setup is, like, a little kind of, like, above our...
But I kind of think the honking and swearing and all that will add to the ambiance of the podcast, don't you?
The swearing is mostly...
Set up a mic for road noise, and then you can, in the edit, have that higher or lower, depending on, you know, tune it up at the beginning, you know, turn it down as the conversation gets hot, and... Increase the road noise as the topic shifts to something else, you know.
Relatedly, at some point with this podcast, I seriously considered, could I get a mobile unit so I could just be out running for a whole episode?
Oh, nice.
Which would probably mean I get very tired after about 10 minutes.
Yeah, out of breath. Yeah.
I thought you were thinking of the kind of like the old, I don't know, David Letterman or Jay Leno thing where he just interviews people on the street, you know, like where is it? Like, does geography quizes and things like that.
No, and entirely self-absorbed, like the person in the modern age, just talking on the cell phone.
Aren't we all just on our little screens? That's why we decided we were going to do this, two people on one screen, so we didn't feel so
this is a first
isolated by modernity. Mm-hmm,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the way, let me say, let's say we were inspired by our students who, like many of them back in 2020, would start about a few months into the semester, they started like sharing screens.
Oh, yeah. It was a kind of beautiful, sad moment together.
At first, we were a little annoyed and even tried to discourage it, but we failed. And now we're celebrating it and, in fact, adopting their approach.
Yeah.
We learn from our students as much as probably more than they learn from us.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck to you guys. It was fantastic chatting with you. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us.
You got it.
Bye, listeners. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.